There's the real story of food, and there's the story of real food. And they meet in a book using two words made into one for its title. Metabolic, meaning the workings of the body, and diabolical, the workings of food, pharma, and the feds. The book is called Metabolical, and its author, Dr. Robert Lustig, is here with us today. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Rob, as impressive as your medical and scientific research is, I'm equally impressed by your references to contemporary culture, from Austin Powers to regenerative agriculture.
I have to make a confession. All of those are my editor. Amy is a master's in public health, so she gets all of the science that I'm writing about. She's the funny one, and she's the one who knows popular culture. So we try to make the books accessible, particularly since they're so science-based. You got to do something to keep people's attention and interest.
All right. Well, I have to also acknowledge that the way you write the science is great, because it is very understandable. And it's really great that in the last, I don't know, maybe 20 years, science really has become more accessible to the general public. So that's a very good thing.
I'm not going to agree with you there. I think science has become much more opaque and much more difficult to understand, and also much more politicized, to the point now where we have basically two camps, the two camps you know, the Democrats and the Republicans, but it's really the people who understand, believe, and gravitate towards science versus the people who eschew it. I would argue that we have not done a very good job of that.
Okay, well, I guess I'm reading more books like yours, and where science is being explained. I'm not a scientist, but I am intrigued and interested in being a responsible consumer and responsible for my own health as much as possible. So regarding the title of your book, Metabolical, it speaks volumes, doesn't it, by bringing in the metabolics of the human body and the diabolical thing that's going on with the powers at be, so to speak. So you're off to a great start right there.
Well, I appreciate that. I gave a lot of thought to the title. I also have to credit my social media director, Wolfram. He was the one who actually came up with the title Metabolical. As soon as I heard it, I went, that's right, that's exactly what it is. I have to say that sometimes titles don't work well, and this one really does.
Yes, and I'm not sure if there's even a mainstream anymore, but what response have you gotten from the so-called establishment, or what has been cleverly named in your book as the blogosphere?
Surprisingly silent. Lots and lots of supportive reviews, but I expected a lot of flack, either members of the food industry or people who were just naysayers and, you know, people who wanted to stick to a calorie is a calorie. And I have to say, I've been really remarkably impressed. There has been virtually no pushback.
Well, bravo. The time has certainly come. And honestly, I don't think we need any more processed food canaries in the coal mine examples to know that processed food is ultimately a poison. Can you talk to us about nutrition not being food science?
Well, these are two different things. And the funny part is, you know, I majored in nutrition and food science in college. So I'm pretty much there when it comes to the difference. So nutrition is everything that happens between the mouth and the cell. And food science is everything that happens between the ground and the mouth. Now, without question, things that happen in food science can affect nutrition. Things that happen in nutrition do not affect food science. You're further downstream. Having said that, you need both. And you need to understand both in order to be able to actually determine metabolic health, because they both go into determining how well you are or how sick you are. And food science has been the black box, opaque to most people. And so what I try to do in this book is blow the lid on that.
Yes, that you do. And what do you think is the most critical medical discovery to move us forward in this direction in the last, I don't know, 25, 50 years or so?
Without question, the discovery of the microbiome. You know, we didn't know about the microbiome before 2002. Jeff Gordon at WashU St. Louis was the first person to take a thin mouse and a fat mouse, take the bacteria out of the intestine of the fat mouse, put it in the thin mouse, and then the thin mouse got fat. And since then, we have been learning about fecal transplants, we've been learning about probiotics and prebiotics, and we've been learning about the fact that a calorie is not a calorie because your intestine chews up 30 to 35% of the calories that you consume. So without doubt, understanding and being able to point to the microbiome as a very specific player in terms of our metabolism and also in terms of our behavior, because the microbiome, those bacteria send signals via the afferent vagus nerve to your brain that tell you whether you're happy, sad, hungry, satiated, angry, and many other things. So you've got an entire brain in your intestine that are basically doing a number on your head. So understanding this concept, without doubt, is the single most important discovery in the whole nutritional field.
Right. Now, for a long time, it was probiotic, probiotic, probiotic. And now it's prebiotic, prebiotic. And what do you have to say about the importance of that? And maybe describe a little bit about the prebiotic, which will help feed and create better and more probiotics.
Right. You know, everybody and his brother have been trying to study the effect of probiotics on disease. So give a probiotic, measure a disease outcome. For instance, give a probiotic to babies and see if they get asthma. And the answer is, every single study, and I dare you to find me a study that counters this, every single study that's been looking for an effect of probiotics on health has come up empty. So the question is, why is that? And the answer is, if you took a probiotic, you should only have to take it once. And the reason is it's a live culture.
Right.
So you swallow the probiotic enters your intestine, and it should set up shop and should grow, and it should be able to do whatever that probiotic does. You should only have to take it once. But everybody who's selling a probiotic basically says you have to take it at least once a day or with every meal or whatever it is, and it doesn't do anything. And the reason it doesn't do anything is because that probiotic never survived. Because if it survived, you'd only need to consume it once. And then the question is, well, how come that probiotic isn't there in the first place? Why is it that you have to replace it? And the reason is because the intestinal environment, the environment that the bacteria find themselves in, is not conducive to its survival. The intestinal environment is a toxic environment that is only letting certain bacteria flourish, and other bacteria are being killed off. The good bacteria and the bad bacteria, if you will. The Bacteroides and the Firmicutes. You want the Bacteroides, you don't want as many Firmicutes. The problem is the Bacteroides are easily killed off, and when they are killed off, the Firmicutes take their place. So there's a balance between the good bacteria and the bad bacteria, and the problem is that because of the intestinal environment, the bad bacteria have their way.
Right.
So if you swallow a good bacteria, is it going to grow? Is it going to take hold? Is it going to battle back the bad bacteria? That all depends on what it's eating. And if that intestinal environment is not conducive to that good bacteria's growth, don't expect it to do anything. So you have to change the intestinal environment. And that is done with something called a prebiotic. All right? That is food for the probiotic.
Right.
That is what a prebiotic is. All right? Food for the probiotic. Well, what is the single most important food that the bacteria in your intestine eat? Answer, fiber. The fiber in your diet. Now, you don't absorb that fiber, but the bacteria in your intestine metabolize that fiber into short-chain fatty acids, which not only help them, but help you. Butyrate, propionate, these are immune regulators. These are insulin suppressors. These are compounds that have metabolic effects that are good for you. Well, those bacteria have to be able to make them, so you have to supply the substrate. Well, the substrate's fiber. Problem is, the fiber's been taken out of our diet by the food industry, specifically for shelf life. So ultra-processed food is basically bad food for bacteria. But if you consume real food, you're getting the fiber that your bacteria need.
Right. There should almost be a warning about reading your book.
Well,
it's very telling.
In fact, there's pasta, and then there's the vegetables that go alongside the pasta. Most people who eat pasta kind of tend to ignore the vegetables.
Right. And you do bring up that two major precepts for health are protecting the liver and feeding the gut. And we just went through a very great explanation. Thank you for that, for feeding the gut. And protecting the liver comes right alongside of that. If there's not a lot of trash to have to clean up, then the liver has a better chance of staying healthy, right?
Indeed. When I say in the book, protect the liver, you know, protect the liver from what? Protect the liver from the massive overflow of simple carbohydrates. Now, there's glucose, there's fructose. When you put those together, that's sucrose. Then there's starch, which is polymerized glucose. All of those flood the liver, are absorbed early in the intestine, unless there's fiber, go straight to the liver. The liver experiences this tsunami of carbohydrate hitting it, and the liver can only burn it at a certain rate. Now, each person has a different rate, and there are things you can do to up that rate, like, for instance, exercise. But whatever it is, if you overwhelm your liver's capacity to be able to metabolize that carbohydrate, your liver has no choice but to take the excess, you know, that's over and above what you can metabolize, and turn that excess into liver fat.
Right.
So your liver is very adept. It has three enzymes that will take sugar and turn it into fat, called de novo lipogenesis, new fat making. Three enzymes. One's called ATP citrate lyase. The next one's called acetyl-CoA carboxylase 1. Third one's called fatty acid synthase. These three enzymes working in concert will take carbohydrate, and in particular fructose, and drive it into the development of fat. Now, the liver then has to do something with that fat. It can either export it out, in which case your serum triglycerides go up, or in some cases, it precipitates in the liver as a lipid droplet, and now you have fatty liver disease, and that causes severe insulin resistance, drives diabetes. That fat in your liver is a bad guy. You do not want fat in your liver. That's not what a normal liver does. It does not want to store that fat. It does not want to make that fat. Well, how do you keep it from doing that? Reduce the substrate. Well, there are substrates, refined carbohydrate and sugar. So that's the first way to protect the liver, is get rid of the substrate. Other things to protect the liver from: glyphosate, Roundup, because that is an amino acid analog. It's an analog of glycine, glyphosate is, and it can appear in your own proteins in your liver and can cause liver dysfunction. Heavy metals, various other chemicals in the environment, pesticides, antibiotics, these are all things you want to protect your liver from. So how do you do that? Well, if you ate real food, you'd be protecting your liver from all of those. Ultra-processed food, unfortunately, is the exact opposite.
Right.
So in each case, protect the liver, feed the gut. Protect the liver from the processed carbohydrate and sugar. Feed the gut with fiber. So basically what you need is a low-sugar, high-fiber diet. That's called real food. Unfortunately, what the CPG industry is purveying is a high-sugar, low-fiber diet. That's called processed food.
Right. You know, one of the things you bring up in your book, that since I'm a big fan of please let's take care of the children, I wasn't aware of the School Nutrition Association. And as you write, that's the biggest proponent for processed food. So thank you for sharing that in your book. And I just wanted to bring that up so the PTAs can get busy here.
Well, they could. I will tell you that the School Nutrition Association is pretty darn opaque. They are definitely on the other side. And the reason they're on the other side is because they get their entire budget from Big Food. They have no reason to question what they are doing. Their job is to supply to children in school that meets the USDA guidelines. That's their job. Okay, and they will tell you that they are doing their job.
Of course.
Problem is that the USDA guidelines are crap.
Right.
The fact that they're doing their job only makes things worse.
Right. There are shifts about Boulder County Schools have an amazing thing going on with this woman, Ann.
Chef Ann Cooper. We know her well.
Yes. Yep. And she's amazing. On her website, she's got everything from the pan to the contacts for good food for any school system to pick it up.
So I'm the chief science officer of a nonprofit here in the Bay Area that actually has a connection with Chef Ann.
Great.
Called Eat Real. She is one of our major proponents, and so we have a very good symbiotic relationship with her.
Wonderful. You do such a great job debunking chronic disease, diseases that aren't really diseases. And what's critical here to understand this?
Well, what's critical is to understand that the disease that your doctor says you have is really not the disease. It is the symptom of the disease. There are 8 diseases that have been going up for the last 50 years in frequency and severity throughout the entire American population and really all across the world. And these are diseases that existed before, but were pretty rare. Now, virtually everyone has them. This is the real epidemic that no one is talking about. And the reason is because it's happened so slowly. The fact of the matter is, if 45% of people today have fatty liver disease, and in 1980, nobody had fatty liver disease, that's an epidemic. Here are these 8 diseases that we call diseases that are not diseases. Type 2 diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia, fatty liver disease, polycystic ovarian disease. Now, all of these diseases existed before 1970. They're not new. On the other hand, virtually nobody had them back in 1970. In 1975, the prevalence of diabetes in the United States, type 2 diabetes, was 1.2%, and specifically over the age of 65, 2.5%. So 2.5% of seniors had type 2 diabetes. Today, that number is 9.4% for the entire population and 15% for seniors. So basically, we have increased our diabetes burden sixfold over the last 50 years in the general population and in seniors. And it is breaking the medical bank. Now, diabetes is a problem, but what about those other 7? All right, cancer is a problem, and it's occurring in younger and younger people. So, you know, that's the canary in the coal mine.
Yes.
When children get it, you know it's the canary in the coal mine. Fatty liver disease was unheard of in children, unheard of. Okay, and today, 20% of children have fatty liver disease and 40% of obese children. So, you know, where did it come from? If nobody had it before, and now it's 20% of children. Prior to 1980, if you saw a patient who had fatty liver, they were an alcoholic. Okay, but children don't drink alcohol. But boy, oh boy, did they consume sugar. Mm-hmm. It turns out sugar and alcohol metabolize virtually identically. So sugar is the alcohol of the child. And what do you think they've been giving to them at the School Nutrition Association? You know, this is really not that surprising when you understand the science.
No, of course.
When you understand the biochemistry.
Yes.
And the point is that these diseases, these eight diseases that I rattled off, okay, they all have one thing in common: dysfunctional mitochondria. Now, the mitochondria are the little energy-burning factories inside each of your cells. Your mitochondria are necessary to make ATP. That's chemical energy that the cell uses to power itself to stay alive. When the ATP in your cell goes down, that cell is vulnerable, it gets sick, and it dies. So anything that interferes with mitochondrial function is a poison. The most famous mitochondrial poison is cyanide. All right, that affects the mitochondria, parts per billion, immediately, keel over and die. All right, well, we don't have cyanide in our food. We have a mitochondrial poison that works chronically in that low level. It's called sugar. And there are three enzymes in the mitochondria that are affected negatively by sugar: AMP kinase, acyl-CoA dehydrogenase long chain, and carnitine palmitoyl transferase 1. These are all enzymes that are necessary to make new and fresh mitochondria and have them work. If those enzymes are not working at peak efficiency, your cell is sluggish, your cell is dysfunctional, and ultimately your cell is going to die. And when your cells die, you die. And that is occurring in every single one of those eight diseases. So those eight diseases are really manifestations of mitochondrial dysfunction. We have to attack the problem.
Right.
In the book, I actually talk about not the eight diseases that I talked about before, but the eight subcellular processes that go on underneath that contribute to chronic disease. I call them either the hateful or grateful eight. When they're working right, you'll be 110 playing tennis. And when they're working wrong, you'll be 40 years old with two stumps in a wheelchair on dialysis waiting for your next stroke. It's that simple. Okay? 110 playing tennis, 40-year-old stumps. Which do you want to be? All right? And all of that has to do with the food. Everything in between is having to do with the food. Now, those eight pathologies are not druggable. They are foodable. And the reason is because they affect the mitochondria in a very specific way. They affect cellular function in a specific way, and drugs can't get there. But food can. Food gets in there. So here are the eight: glycation, oxidative stress, mitochondrial dysfunction, like we talked about, insulin resistance, membrane instability, inflammation, methylation, and autophagy. Now, these are eight processes. None of them have an ICD-11 code. None of them are things your doctor can bill for. And since none of them have a drug, your doctor doesn't know what they are and doesn't tell you about them. So basically, the medical profession has ignored them and has not dealt with them. And the reason is because they don't have a medicine for it. They're not druggable, but they are foodable. And if you look at each of those, and I have, and in the book I explain how, if you look at each one of those eight subcellular pathologies, okay, the molecular mechanisms that get you to function or dysfunction all have food as supportive efforts, whereas they have processed food as detracting and negative elements. Okay, so omega-3s are important. Fructose is important to get rid of. Folate is important. B12 is important. Low insulin levels are important for a lot of these. So the bottom line is, when you look at each of those eight, real food makes them better, and processed food makes them worse.
Right. And I think it's important to mention here, too, that as you mentioned with the probiotics, supplementation can be like a drug. It's not a food.
Well, if you are deficient in something, then you can supplement it. If you have an excess of something, you can't supplement it. So this metabolic problem is really, other than omega-3s, is really more of an excess problem than it is a deficiency problem. And there's no pill to get rid of an excess. So, yes, you can take vitamin D if you're vitamin D deficient. Yes, you can take omega-3s if you're omega-3 deficient. Yes, you can take vitamin C if you're vitamin C deficient. And guess what? I do. Those three. But pretty much everything else in the health food store, there's no data to support the use of any of those. And the reason is because they're not really treating a deficiency because you're not deficient in those things. You have to understand what these things do and how they work to determine whether or not they actually do work. Otherwise, you're just throwing your money down the toilet. The nutraceutical industry is a $200 billion industry in the United States. All right? And 71% of people take some form of nutraceutical. Now, I do too. So I'm not telling people that it's a complete sham. And if you're sick or, like, you know, have malabsorption problems, you're on chemotherapy, where your folate is going down the tubes and you need to supplement it, you know, I'm not telling you that those are, that's a bad thing to do. The point is, and you have to know what that reason is, rather than just think that somehow you can nutraceutical your way out of chronic disease, because that's not true.
Right. You know, I think another current thing that's going on is the measurements and what's considered normal. And I think normal can be a dangerous concept.
Oh, for sure. I tell people straight out, if you're at your doctor's office and your doctor uses the word normal, leave.
Okay? Oh, no.
That should be a trigger word. Okay? There is no such thing as normal. All right? The only reason your doctor says your certain lab test or whatever is normal is because he looked at the side of the lab slip, H or an L, high, low, okay? And if it doesn't say H or L, then it's normal, normal range of that laboratory study.
Right, which they change on occasion, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. So the question is, how do you know what's normal? The answer is the lab doesn't know. The lab has no idea what normal is. What the lab does to figure out the normal range on any given lab test is they take 200,000 lab tests on people that they think are not sick, and they do the mean and standard deviation around the distribution. And at two standard deviations, at the top or at the bottom, they draw a line and say, okay, anything above that or below that, that's abnormal. And anything in between, that's normal. All right? It's just that simple. So it's a statistical fudge. That doesn't make it normal. Because if those 300,000 people were all healthy, then whatever their number was normal. And 2.5% of the population will have a lab value above the 2.5 percentile. And they're still normal. So none of this makes sense for people.
Yeah.
In addition, some of those normal ranges have been changing because people have been getting sick. So if you have fatty liver disease, which 45% of the population now does, your ALT, alanine aminotransferase, which is a marker for fatty liver, it's sensitive, not specific, but it's still a reasonably good marker, your ALT will go up. Now, when I entered medical school in 1975, the upper limit of normal for ALT was 25. 45 years later, the upper limit for ALT is 40. 25, 40. Nice. How come it went up? And the answer is because everyone has fatty liver disease.
Right.
And they don't know it. And so the lab just looks at this population and says, okay, here's the break point. That's all the way up to 40. That doesn't make 40 normal. If you've got 40, you've got fatty liver disease. All right, but your doctor will tell you, well, it's normal because the lab slip says so.
Right.
So
sickening.
Understanding how we got here, understanding what this means, understanding the what statistics mean and how you can lie with statistics is absolutely essential for being a good doctor. Unfortunately, doctors are not usually taught that in medical school. And I know because I'm one of the people who had to undo it.
Yes. Now, Rob, what current medical or food myth would you like to just see disappear totally out of human consciousness?
That's easy. One word. I am on a mission, an academic mission, not a zealot's mission, but an academic mission to kill the calorie as a unit of measurement for nutrition. Calories don't matter. And the reason the calories don't matter is because you measure calories at the mouth. Who cares? What you need to do is measure calories at the intestine. What gets absorbed? So if you ate it, but it went to your microbiome, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing.
Right.
So
is there a way to measure it now?
No.
In the intestine?
Not yet. That's a very hard thing to do. We have to do it in the laboratory, you know, with
right.
research tools. So there's no easy way to do that. The point is that if 30% of the calories that you consume go to your microbiome and don't even enter your bloodstream, then why do you care what the number of calories you ate was? Now, the number of grams of sugar you ate, that matters a lot. The number of grams of omega-3s you eat, that matters a lot. Okay, so there are things that you could learn, but they're not on the food label. So the fact of the matter is the food label is very disingenuous and doesn't really tell you what you need to know. And so we are actually putting together a database that will help the consumer do just that, to be able to actually figure out what's in their food, what's been done to their food, and whether or not that food will actually confirm metabolic health or metabolic illness. And that database is called PERFACT, P-E-R-F-A-C-T. And it is in beta testing right now, and we plan on releasing it probably sometime next year.
Wonderful. And as you write, in God we trust, and everyone else has to show the data.
That's a UCSFism. Right? At UCSF, it's put up or shut up. All right. And in my division, we used to have what we called gladiator rounds, where basically everybody had to justify everything that came out of their mouths.
All right.
You know, basically, no bullshit here.
Right.
And this is the way I conduct all of my work. Show me the science. Prove it to me. I'm very open. I'm very open to changing my opinion. In fact, that's what research is. Research is basically overthrowing the previous generation's dogma. If we didn't do research, we would basically be steeped in the dark ages. All right? So understanding how things advance and knowing what the criteria that has to be met to be able to advance is absolutely essential for any doctor, any scientist, and really for the general public. But they're not taught how. And that is one of the most egregious problems with our education system today, that kids are not taught science. And I'm trying to do what I can to try to fix that.
Yes is the answer. Get a hold of Dr. Robert Lustig's book, Metabolical. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on the usual platforms. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.